Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by CWB and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past. Chapter 15, Faiaipo, In Love. Summary: Sherlock and still-injured John find a routine that works for them on Cassiopeia. Love is in the air and in the ice cave, and Sherlock and Marilla meet for the first time. Sherlock and John's days shift and evolve until they've taken on a distinct pattern. Each morning they wake together in the crèche. More often than not, Sherlock opens his eyes first and checks to see that John is close, that his shoulder is free of any impediment, and that he is still as adorable as he was the day before. Each day, much to Sherlock's delight, John proves to be even more adorable. From this point forward, Sherlock fights with himself. He wants to let John sleep, but he cannot resist his urges to touch John, to groom him, to kiss his bill, his oral patches, his neck. He tries to be quiet and still, but sometimes, as if sleeping John can sense that Sherlock is awake, John will lean into him, or push a wing under his, or snuggle his face against Sherlock's neck, and Sherlock cannot imagine how anyone would expect him not to lean back or tighten his grip. Or snuggle back. After all, he's only Penguin. Then John will mumble into Sherlock's feathers and yawn, then open one eye, then the other, and then stretch. This movement separates him from Sherlock, but also bends and flexes his body in the most tantalizing way. Wings pulled back, neck extended, belly long and flat. John becomes a taut canvas that Sherlock wants to mark. He's not sure how to do that without drawing attention to them, so instead, when John is ready, after he's greeted Sherlock with an affectionate "Morning," they will head to a nearby swimming hole, the one that the scouts have designated as safest, and have breakfast. John stays on the perimeter of the opening in the ice, and Sherlock dives in, catches krill and shrimp and the occasional miniature cephalopod, and tosses it back up to John. When John has a large enough collection at his feet, Sherlock resurfaces and they eat together. John says over and over that he feels useless lurking above while Sherlock hunts for both of them. His shoulder is healing beautifully, according to Cetus, and John wants back in the game. Cetus also says, and Sherlock reminds John of this, that healing beautifully and completely healed are not interchangeable terms, and that John would do well to wait a little longer before he resumes swimming. Sherlock is learning that the best way to manage John's grumps and whinges about his relative immobility is to ignore him. When Sherlock tries to assuage John's complaints, John argues back with greater fervor. When Sherlock argues back more vociferously, John goes quiet. So instead, Sherlock stays silent while John lets everyone nearby know how unhappy he is with his current non-swimming situation. Sherlock slips into the water mid-sentence and tosses breakfast onto the ice. The sooner John has food, the sooner he stops grumbling. When they've eaten their fill, Sherlock lets John take him around to socialize with his various friends, and Sherlock practices being less than rude. The goal is polite, but Atlantis wasn't built in a day, and neither will be Sherlock's social persona. John instructs Sherlock to smile, but not the creepy smile, to use simple greetings, and to not deduce out loud unless he is in an observation that he knows will make another Peng happy. Sherlock knows that he's supposed to engage in conversation, but prefers to wait until someone asks him a question, or John says, "What do you reckon, Sherlock?" Or, "Oh, well, Sherlock is an expert at that. Let's hear what he has to say." Sherlock tolerates this. He tolerates this because he and John have confessed their feelings to each other, and one of the unforeseen advantages of navigating that particular tsunami of potential emotional disasters is that John touches Sherlock all of the time now, and Sherlock is allowed and encouraged to touch John back. It is delightful. It is unadulterated joy to stand in company with John and let the tip of his wing trail down his back, or feel John's wing under his, or lean into each other as they listen to someone else pontificate about sky warming and melting ice caps. They are one of the first, but are not the only young pairing that Sherlock observes. They are of that age, smack in the middle of adolescence, when quickly changing pangs start to take notice of each other, grow bolder in their flirting. Interested parties test the waters, advance, retreat, advance again. He watches his peers dance around each other, trying more adult behaviors on for size. Couples form and dissolve around them. He, however, feels as sure and steady as Cassiopeia with John. This is not fleeting. He detects no change in the way those around them perceive or react to them. Again, he reflects on Elder Erebus's words, that pangs see what they want to see, what they are used to seeing. Two males together indicate friendship, so if they touch each other, it is friendly touching. He does not try to draw attention to their relationship, but neither does he deny the consequences of allowing his heart these feelings. He wants to touch John. The way Sherlock sees it, anyone truly paying attention would know that John is his and he is John's. He's pretty sure that Mycroft, Mama, and Seeger are paying attention. Harriet is paying attention. Elder Erebus continues to pay attention. And now, Marilla is paying attention. In the first few days after the attack, Sherlock refuses to go anywhere near her. He knows that she has not apologized to John for her vicious bite, and that John doesn't expect her to. John says that Marilla didn't do it on purpose, that she was in a state of panic when it happened, and that she is not to be held accountable. Sherlock says that even baby pangs are taught to apologize for hurting another, even if the circumstances are accidental. John counters by reminding Sherlock that baby pangs are also taught to be generous with their forgiveness, but Sherlock doesn't see what one has to do with the other. Marilla should say she's sorry, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. Everything comes to a head one morning when John is discussing Cetus's new apprenticeship lessons with Malling and Stamford. The program is mostly rumor so far, but all three are excited about the possibility and eager to participate if given the opportunity. Sherlock stays at John's side, pretending to listen, as he's already heard the same conversation many times over. He watches pangs around them go about their business, and soon notices Marilla approaching from over John's shoulder. He cannot help but notice how her posture changes as soon as she sees John, how she pulls her shoulders back and grooms her face and shakes out her tail feathers. Sherlock is flabbergasted by how intuitive these moves appear to be. He is also, he must admit, just a little bit impressed by her nerve. He presses himself up against John's sides so hard they almost topple over, but John takes it in his stride and wraps his wing around Sherlock's back as he continues to talk. Sherlock nuzzles John's ear. Stamford attempts the wing hug on Malling, but Malling just glares at him before stepping away. Sherlock finds the dynamic fascinating. Marilla stops at the edge of their foursome, close enough to be noticed, but not close enough to join the group. She's waiting to be invited, he realizes, because an invitation makes her more a part of the group than her own self-insertion. Oh, she is clever, isn't she? And who most likely to see her first to acknowledge her, based on where she has chosen to stand? John, of course. It takes less than 3 heartbeats for John to pause, turn, and extend the wing not wrapped around Sherlock. Marilla, you know everyone, don't you? Marilla gives a shy nod and makes eye contact with Malling and Stamford, but does not look at Sherlock. He wants to laugh out loud. He didn't know such game playing existed, but recognizes it in every move she makes. Now that he sees her in action, he knows exactly how to play. Just as she's about to speak, he interrupts and says, "Actually, I don't believe we've met. Irina, did you say?" Her bill is still hanging open when John says, "Sherlock, this is Marilla. Marilla, you've met Sherlock before, haven't you?" She cocks her head and gives Sherlock a brief, indifferent look, then says, "I don't really know, to be honest. Would I have remembered?" Sherlock cannot resist the opening. He knows that John won't like what he is about to do, but the words are rolling into his mouth and off his tongue as if each and every one had a little brain of its own. "You certainly would have, and now you'll never forget. I am Sherlock of Counselpeng, Seeger, and Olive, and Maximus, Steady, Frederick, and Clementa before them. I am sibling to Mycroft, and soon to take a seat on the Junior Council. More importantly, I am John's Ipo, his Anahe, and if you ever bite, injure, hurt, or so much as look at him the wrong way again, you will answer to me and mine." The response is not quite what he had hoped. John shouts, "Sherlock!" Stamfier gapes at him. Malling looks like she wants to slap him. But Marla? Marla laughs. She throws her head back and laughs and said, "Oh dear, aren't you precious? John did say you have a flair for the dramatic, didn't you, John?" Playing this game takes more strategy and foresight than Sherlock had previously thought, but he considers himself up to the challenge. "John is blinded by his affection for me. He can't be held accountable for what he says. You, however, can be held accountable. Speaking of which, don't you think John's shoulder is healing well? It's nothing short of a miracle, really, in light of the damage you did with that barbed tongue of yours." Now John is gaping, too. Sherlock sees a tiny crack in Marilla's armor, so he plunges ahead. "Cetus told us he might not ever swim again. Luckily, you won't have that burden to bear. I've made sure he doesn't overdo himself until it's good as new. How about you? How have you been spending your time, other than not apologizing?" John throws his wings into the air and stomps a few paces away. Stamfyard backs up. Marla steps up her game and bursts into tears, and Malling hurries to comfort her, tutting over her shoulder at Sherlock. "She just lost her parents," she whispers, shouts at him. Over Malling's shoulder, Marla smirks at Sherlock. For the love of Poseidon, Sherlock thinks, she's good. "Foster parents, sick and set. She never knew her real parents." John, Malling, and Stamfyard all stare at him, then turn and stare at her. Marla pries herself out of Malling's grip and glares at him. "How did you know that?"
"I didn't know. I observed, and based on your reaction, I'd say I was correct."
"Not quite. Third set."
"There's always something,
isn't there, though?"
"Are you two done?"
John asks, still bristling in understated fury. It's a good look for him, Sherlock thinks. Marilla sighs and extends one wing toward Sherlock.
"Can we please start again?"
She's herself now, Sherlock observes. No coy expressions, no phony posturing. She's not playing anymore, and he respects her for it. He drops the facade, too, smooths down the feathers on the top of his head, and extends his wing.
"Sherlock."
"Marilla."
"Oh, my God," John huffs. "You two are perfect for each other, and I'm hungry. Can we eat?"
Sherlock leaves the encounter with two observations. She still hasn't apologized, and adoption is allowed in his colony. Every day after breakfast, socializing and lunch, John and Sherlock sneak away to their ice cave. They don't invite anyone to join them, and they never announce their departure. The trail under their feet becomes more familiar as each day passes, until they know each bump, each crack, each slick spot. Knowledge of the path translates into confidence in their step, and the journey shortens. Each day they carry some little treasure with them, something to adorn the space and make it more their own. Cassiopeia doesn't offer much in the way of decoration, but they acquire a growing collection of albatross, petrel, and cormorant feathers, assorted fish bones, and one curved triangular tooth. They both know it once sat in a seal's mouth, but neither feels the need to discuss it. The treasures are tucked in a line along an interior wall of the cave, safe from the winds that lick around the berg. John arranges them, and when he's not looking, Sherlock rearranges them, and each day the cave looks less like a fort and more like a home away from home. Here, too, they find a routine. They fuss for a bit with their treasure collection, and then they move to the ledge and look out over the world. They start with their own corner of it, commenting on the colony below, rich in detail and the potential for storytelling. They watch their peers and make up tales about the whys and wheres and whos of their comings and goings. Beyond the colony is the sea, sometimes peaceful, sometimes stormy, always endless. There's less to say about the water's surface, so they surmise what might be unfolding underneath. Then there is the sky stitched to the horizon, rising up and over them, a ceiling against which clouds roll and bump. The sky hears everything they have to say, but offers little inspiration of its own. When the last story has been told, they turn away from the world outside, toward each other, and work on weaving the best story. Their story. Sherlock has found great freedom in telling John how he feels, and that freedom has fueled great curiosity. He cannot explain why gestures that were once innocent and affectionate are now heady and maddening. Everything takes on an air of urgency. Every touch feels illicit, each move infused with electricity. It always starts the same way, a smile or a wink, a brush of bill against bill. It takes such control not to rush the connection. They take tentative steps toward each other, letting the tension build until the shallow space between them vibrates and quivers. At the first press of one warm belly to the other, Sherlock might sigh, John might hum. Wings lift and flutter in silent question, "Can I?" The answer is always quick and sure. "Yes, please. Oh, please." A closer embrace, a more insistent nudge, necks twining and curling and rubbing. At first they only do this, necking for long afternoons in the blue light of their secret ice cave. Soon, though, their necking inspires further exploration, and then the undersides and tips of silken wings find tender spots along chests and ribs and flanks. Sherlock is drawn to the downward slope of John's belly to thigh. The feathers here are short and sleek over hard, flexing muscle. It takes him days to work up the nerve to let his desire take flight, to let his touch drift in that direction, and when he does, unable to stand one more heartbeat of curious torture, John goes weak in the knees and loses his breath. "Lean on me," Sherlock whispers, and John wraps both wings around Sherlock's neck and lets his cheek rest on a soft shoulder. Sherlock presses along the seam of leg and torso, tracing the indentation up and over the curve of hip, then back down further into the crease of John's groin. John pants and slides his feet further apart. Sherlock trills deep in his chest, a growl, a groan. There is a tightness inside him, deep and low, and it thrums in time with his heartbeat. His breath is more of an attempt than a fact, air dancing in his throat, just barely reaching his lungs before bursting back out of his mouth. It sounds loud in his ears. John lets one wing drift down Sherlock's side, then resettles it on Sherlock's lower belly. He rubs in soft, tentative circles, and Sherlock presses himself into the touch. Emboldened, John slides his wingtips straight down Sherlock's midline. He pauses when Sherlock nips at John's throat. That tight place deep inside squeezes hard, and Sherlock finds himself frozen in place, waves of arousal flooding him from head to toe. The walls of the ice cave take his whimper and throw it back and forth. Sherlock needs to see John's face. He arches his neck and bumps John's bill up, and John, who is staring down between Sherlock's legs, drags his gaze up and blinks. Sherlock rubs his bill along the side of John's, and they pant into each other's mouths. Somewhere close in front of them exists an invisible line that they both know not to cross, although neither one knows where it is or what they will find when they reach it. They know they need to slow down. Wings come back to sides, breathing regulates. They stand, foreheads touching, and murmur into each other's ears. The light outside has deepened and dimmed. How long have they been gone? Sherlock figures that in order to be aware of the passing of time, you must be aware of the environment around you. And in order to be aware of the environment around you, you must use all of your senses. Vision, hearing, taste, smell, touch. It all combines to inform you of time and space. When all of his senses have been centered on John, John is his only environment. Being with John makes time stand still. Notes, Maori translations. Faiaipo, verb, to be in love with, noun, sweetheart, lover, betrothed, fiancé, fiancée, boyfriend and girlfriend. Ipo, lover, sweetheart, darling, beloved one. Anahe, only, none but, nothing but, without exception, no one else, no others. Sherlock and John aren't chicks anymore, but they aren't adults either, and their markings reflect that. They are still black and white, without the orange bits. When I first started writing this, I couldn't find good examples about what juveniles would look like, so I went ahead and gave John his colored bill. Turns out I was ahead of myself. That's okay, I'll just invoke my right to artistic freedom.